life with his own death. The young man looked briefly troubled, then shrugged. Like I say, some people would say they're too soft. He took the little gun from the footboard and put it into a pocket of his pantaloons. The man stood slowly. The ethnarch's heart still pounded, but in his eyes there were tears. The young man leant down, picked up some clothes and threw them at the ethnarch, who grabbed at them and held them to his chest.
My offer stands, the ethnarch Kerian said. I can give you
job satisfaction. The young man sighed, staring at one set of fingernails. That's all you can give me, ethnarch. I'm not interested in anything else. Get dressed. You're leaving. The ethnarch started to pull on his shirt.
Are you sure? I believe I have invented some new vices even the old empire didn't know about. I'd be willing to share them with you.
No. Thank you.
Who are these people you're talking about, anyway?
The ethnarch fastened his buttons.
And may I yet know your name?
Just get dressed.
Well, I still think we can come to some sort of arrangement.
The ethnarch secured his collar.
And this is all really quite ridiculous, but I suppose I ought to be thankful you're not an assassin, eh?
The young man smiled, seemed to pick something from a fingernail. He put his hands in the pantaloon pockets as the ethnarch kicked the bedclothes down and picked up his breeches. Yes, the young man said. Must be rather awful thinking you're about to die.
Not the most pleasant experience, agreed the ethnarch,
putting one leg, then another into his trousers.
But such a relief, I imagine, when you get the reprieve.
The ethnarch gave a small laugh.
A bit like being rounded up in a village and thinking you're going to be shot, the young man mused, facing the ethnarch from the foot of the bed, and then being told your fate is nothing worse than resettlement.
He smiled. The ethnarch hesitated. Resettled by train, the man said, taking the little black gun out of his pocket.
By a train which contains your family, your street, your village.
The young man adjusted something on the small black gun,
and then ends up containing nothing but engine fumes and lots of dead people.
He smiled thinly.
What do you think, ethnarch Kerian? Something like that?
The ethnarch stopped moving, staring wide-eyed at the gun.
The nice people are called the culture, the young man explained, and I always did think they were too soft.
He stretched his arm out, holding the gun.
I stopped working for them some time ago. I'm freelance now.
The ethnarch looked speechless into the dark, ancient eyes above the barrel of the black gun.
I, said the man, am called Sheradanin Zakalwe.
He levelled the gun at the ethnarch's nose.
You are called dead.
He fired the gun. The ethnarch had put his head back and started to scream, so the single shot pierced the roof of his mouth before it exploded inside his skull. Brains splattered over the ornate headboard. The body thumped into the skin-soft bedclothes and twitched once, spreading blood. He watched the blood as it pooled. He blinked a couple of times. Then, moving slowly, he peeled off the gaudy clothes. He put them in a small black rucksack. Underneath, the one-piece suit was shadow dark. He took the matte black mask from the rucksack and put it round his neck, though not yet over his face. He moved to the head of the bed and peeled a little transparent patch from the neck of the sleeping girl, then went back into the dark depths of the room, slipping the mask over his face as he did so. Using the night sight, he unclipped the panel over the security system's control unit and carefully removed several small boxes. Then, walking very softly and slowly now, he crossed to the wall-sized pornographic painting, which concealed the door to the ethnarch's emergency escape route, to the sewers and the palace roof. He turned back before he slowly closed the door and looked at the bloody mess on the curved, carved surface of the headboard. He smiled his thin smile, a little uncertainly. Then he slipped away into the stone-black depths of the palace, like a piece of the night.
Chapter 2.
The dam lay wedged between the tree-studded hills like a fragment from some enormous shattered cup. The morning sunshine shone up the valley,
hit the concave grey face of the dam and produced a white reflecting flood of light. Behind the dam, the long diminished lake was dark and cold. The water came less than halfway up the massive concrete bulwark, and the forests beyond had long since reclaimed over half the slopes the dam's rising water had once drowned. Sailboats lay tethered to jetties, strung along one side of the lake, the chopping waters slapping at their glistening hulls. High overhead, birds carved the air, circling in the warmth of the sunlight above the shadow of the dam. One of the birds dipped and swooped, gliding down towards the lip of the dam and the deserted roadway, which ran along its curved summit. The bird pulled its wings in just as it seemed it was about to collide with the white railings, which ran on either side of the road. It flashed between the dew-sparkled stanchions, executed a half-roll, partially opened its wings again, and plummeted towards the obsolete power station that had become the grandly eccentric, not to mention pointedly symbolic, home of the woman called Dizziet Sma. The bird settled belly down to the swoop and, level with the roof garden, flung out its wings, grasping at the air and fluttering to a precipitous halt, talons tacketing down on a window ledge set in the highest story of the old admin block apartments. Wings folded, soot-dark head to one side, one beady eye reflecting the concrete light, the bird hopped forward to a slid-open window where soft red curtains rippled out into the breeze. It stuck its head under the fluttering hem of the material and peered into the darkened room beyond. "You missed it," Sma said with quiet scorn, happening to pad past the window just at that moment. She sipped from a glass of water she held. Droplets from her shower beaded her tawny body. The bird's head swiveled, following her as she crossed to the closet and commenced to dress. Swiveling back, the bird's gaze shifted to the male body lying in the air a little less than a metre above the floor-mounted bed base. Inside the dim haze of the bed's AG field, the pale figure of Relstok Susepin stirred and rolled over in mid-air. His arms floated out to either side, until the weak centering field on his side of the bed brought them slowly back in towards his body again. In the dressing room, Sma gargled with some water, then swallowed it. 50 meters east, Skaffin Antiskor floated high in the air above the floor of the turbine hall, surveying the wreckage of the party. The section of the drone's mind that was controlling the guard drone disguised as a bird took a last look at the filigree of scratches on Susepin's buttocks and the already fading bite marks on Smar's shoulders as she covered them with a gauzy shirt, and then released the guard drone from its control. The bird squawked, jumped back from the curtain, and fell fluttering and frenzied off the ledge before opening its wings and beating back up past the gleaming face of the dam, its shrill alarm cries echoing back from the concrete slopes and disturbing it further. Sma heard the distant feedback of commotion as she buttoned her waistcoat and smiled.
"Good night, sleep,"
Skaffin Antiskor inquired as it met her at the portico of the old admin block.
"Good night. No sleep."
Sma yawned, shooing the whining Heralses back into the building's marble hall, where Makril, the major domo, stood unhappily with a bunch of leads. She stepped out into the sunlight, pulling on gloves. The drone held the car door open for her. She filled her lungs with the fresh morning air and ran down the steps, boot heels clattering. She jumped into the car, winced a little as she settled in the driver's seat, then flicked a switch that started the roof folding back while the drone loaded her luggage into the trunk. She tapped the battery gauges on the vehicle's dash and blipped the accelerator, just to feel the wheel motors strain against the brakes. The drone secured the trunk and floated into the rear seats. She waved to Makril, who was chasing one of her Heralses along the steps outside the turbine hall, and didn't notice. Sma laughed, stood on the throttle, and slipped the brakes. The car leapt off in a spray of gravel, took the right-hander beneath the trees with centimetres to spare, shot out through the station's granite gates with a farewell shimmy of its rear end, and accelerated hard down Riverside Drive.
"We could have flown,"
the drone pointed out, over the rush of air, but it suspected Sma wasn't listening. The semantics of fortification were pan-cultural, she thought, as she descended the stone steps from the curtained wall of the castle, gazing up at the drum-shaped keep, hazy in the distance on its hill behind several more layers of walls. She walked across the grass, Skaffin Amtiskor at her shoulder, and exited the fort through a postern. The view led down to the new port and the straits, where sea ships passed smoothly in the late morning sunlight, heading for ocean or inland sea according to their lanes.
From the other side of the castle complex, the city revealed its presence with a distant rumble and, because the light wind came from that direction, the smell of... Well, she just thought of it as city after 3 years here. She supposed all cities smelled different, though. Dizzy at Smar sat on the grass with her legs drawn up to her chin and looked out across the straits and their arching suspension bridges to the subcontinent on the far shore.
"Anything else?" the drone asked.
"Yeah, take my name off the judging panel for the Academy show and send a stalling letter to that Petrain guy."
She frowned in the sunlight, shading her eyes.
"Can't think of anything else."
The drone moved in front of her, teasing a small flower from the grass in front of her and playing with it.
"Xenophobes just entered the system," it told her.
"Well, happy day," Smar said sourly.
She wetted one finger and rubbed a little speck of dirt from the toe of one boot.
"And that young man in your bed just surfaced, asking Makril where you've got to."
Smar said nothing, though her shoulders shook once and she smiled. She lay back on the grass, one arm behind her. The sky was aquamarine, stroked with clouds. She could smell the grass and taste the scent of small, crushed flowers. She looked back up over her forehead at the grey-black wall towering behind her and wondered if the castle had ever been attacked on days like this. Did the sky seem so limitless, the waters of the straits so fresh and clean, the flowers so bright and fragrant, when men fought and screamed, hacked and staggered and fell, and watched their blood mat the grass? Mists and dusk, rain and lowering cloud seemed the better background, clothes to cover the shame of battle. She stretched, suddenly tired, and shivered with a little flashback of the night's exertions. And like somebody holding something precious and it slipping from their fingers but them having the speed and the skill to catch it again before it hit the floor, she was able, somewhere inside herself, to dip down and retrieve the vanishing memory as it slipped back into the clutter and noise of her mind, and, glanding recall, she held it, savoured it, re-experienced it, until she felt herself shiver again in the sunlight and came close to making a little moaning noise. She let the memory escape and coughed and sat up, glancing to see if the drone had noticed. It was nearby, collecting tiny flowers. A party of what she guessed were schoolchildren came chattering and squealing up the path from the metro station, heading towards the postern. Heading and tailing the noisy column were adults, possessed of that air of calmly tired wariness she'd seen before in teachers and mothers with many children. Some of the kids pointed at the floating drone as they passed, wide-eyed and giggling and asking questions, before they were ushered through the narrow gate, voices disappearing. It was, she'd noticed, always the children who made a fuss like that. Adults just assumed that there was some trick behind the apparently unsupported body of the machine, but children wanted to know how it worked. One or two scientists and engineers had looked startled too, but she guessed a stereotype of unworldliness meant nobody believed them that there must be something odd going on. Anti-gravity was what was going on, and the drone in this society was like a flashlight in the Stone Age, but to her surprise, it was almost disappointingly easy just to brazen it out.
"The ships just met up," the drone informed her. "They're transferring the stand-in for real, rather than displacing it."
Smar laughed, plucked a blade of grass and sucked on it.
"Old JT really doesn't trust its displacer, does it?"
"I think the thing's senile myself," the drone said sniffily.
It was carefully slicing holes in the barely more than hair-thin stems of the flowers it had picked, then threading the stems through each other, creating a little chain. Smar watched the machine, its unseen fields manipulating the little blossoms as dexterously as any lacemaker flicking a pattern into existence. It was not always so refined. Once, maybe 20 years ago, far away on another planet, in another part of the galaxy altogether, on the floor of a dry sea, forever scoured by howling winds, beneath the mesa that had been islands on the dust that had been silt, she had lodged in a small frontier town at the limit of the railway's reach, preparatory to hiring mounts to venture into the deep desert and search out the new child messiah. At dusk, the riders came into the square to take her from the inn. They'd heard her strangely coloured skin alone would fetch a handsome price. The innkeeper made the mistake of trying to reason with the men and was pinned to his own door with a sword. His daughters wept over him before they were dragged away. Smar turned, sickened from the window, heard boots thunder on the rickety stairs. Scaffin Amtiskor was near the door. It looked unhurried at her. Screams came from the square outside and from elsewhere inside the inn. Somebody battered at the door of her room, loosing dust and shaking the floor. Smar was wide-eyed, bereft of stratagems. She stared at the drone.
"Do something," she gulped.
"My pleasure," murmured Scaffin Amtiskor.
The door burst open, slamming against the mud wall. Smar flinched. The two black-cloaked men filled the doorway. She could smell them. One strode in towards her, sword out, rope in the other hand, not noticing the drone at one side.
"Excuse me," said Scaffin Amtiskor.
The man glanced at the machine without breaking stride. Then he wasn't there anymore, and dust filled the room, and Smar's ears were ringing, and pieces of mud and paper were falling from the ceiling and fluttering through the air. And there was a large hole straight through the wall into the next room, across from where Scaffin Amtiskor, seemingly defying the law concerning action-reaction, hovered in exactly the same place as before. A woman shrieked hysterically in the room through the hole, where what was left of the man was embedded in the wall above her bed. His blood spattered copiously over ceiling, floor, walls, bed and her. The second man whirled into the room, discharging a long gun point-blank at the drone. The bullet became a flat coin of metal a centimetre in front of the machine's snout and clunked to the floor. The man unsheathed and swung his sword in one flashing movement, scything at the drone through the dust and smoke. The blade broke cleanly on a bump of red-coloured field just above the machine's casing. Then the man was lifted off his feet. Smar was crouched down in one corner, dust in her mouth and hands at her ears, listening to herself scream. The man thrashed wildly in the centre of the room for a second, then he was a blur through the air above her. There was another colossal pulse of sound, and a ragged aperture appeared in the wall over her head, beside the window looking out to the square. The floorboards jumped, and dust choked her.
"Stop!"
she screamed. The wall above the hole cracked, and the ceiling creaked and bowed down, releasing lumps of mud and straw. Dust clogged her mouth and nose, and she struggled to her feet, almost throwing herself out of the window in her desperate attempt to find air.
"Stop!"
she croaked, coughing dust. The drone floated smoothly to her side, wafting dust away from Smar's face with a field plane and supporting the sagging ceiling with a slender column. Both field components were shaded deep red, the colour of drone pleasure.
"There, there," Scaffin Amtiskor said to her, patting her back.
Smar choked and spluttered from the window and stared horrified at the square below. The body of the second man lay like a sodden red sack under a cloud of dust in the midst of the riders. While they were still staring, before most of the raiders could raise their swords, and before the innkeeper's daughters, being lashed to two of the mounts by their captors, realised what the almost unrecognisable lump on the ground in front of them was and started screaming again, something thrummed past Smar's shoulder and darted down towards the men. One of the warriors roared, brandishing his sword and lunging towards the door of the inn. He managed two steps. He was still roaring when the knife missile flicked past him, field outstretched. It separated his neck from his shoulders. The roar turned to a sound like the wind bubbling thickly through the exposed windpipe as his body crashed to the dust. Faster, and turning more tightly than any bird or insect, the knife missile made an almost invisibly quick circle round most of the riders, producing an odd stuttering noise. Seven of the riders, five standing, two still mounted, collapsed into the dust in 14 separate pieces. Smar tried to scream at the drone to make the missile stop, but she was still choking and now starting to retch. The drone patted her back.
"There, there," it said concernedly.
In the square, both of the innkeeper's daughters slipped to the ground from the mounts they had been tied to, their bonds slashed in the same cut that had killed all seven men. The drone gave a little shudder of satisfaction. One man dropped his sword and started to run. The knife missile plunged straight through him. It curved like red light shining on a hook and then slashed across the necks of the last two dismounted riders, felling both. The mount of the final rider was rearing up in front of the missile, its fangs bared, forelegs lashing, claws exposed. The device went through its neck and straight into the face of its rider. On emerging from the resulting detonation, the machine slammed to a stop in midair, while the rider's headless body slid off his collapsing, thrashing animal. The knife missile spun slowly about, seemingly reviewing its few seconds' work, then it started to float back towards the window. The innkeeper's daughters had fainted. Smar vomited. The frenzied mounts leapt and screamed and ran about the courtyard, a couple of them dragging bits of their riders with them. The knife missile swooped and butted one of the hysterical mounts on the head, just as the animal was about to trample the two girls lying still in the dust. Then the tiny machine dragged them both out of the carnage towards the doorway where their father's body lay. Finally, the sleek, spotless little device rose gently to the window, daintily avoiding Smar's projected bile, and snicked back into the drone's casing.
Bastard!
Smar tried to punch the drone, then kick it, then picked up a small chair and smashed it against the drone's body.
Bastard! You fucking murderous bastard!
Smar, the drone said reasonably, not moving in the slowly settling maelstrom of dust and still holding the ceiling up. You said do something.
Meat fucker!
She smashed a table across its back.
Miss Smar, language.
You split prick shit! I told you to stop!
Oh, did you? I didn't quite catch that. Sorry.
She stopped then, hearing the utter lack of concern in the machine's voice. She thought very clearly that she had a choice here. She could collapse, weeping and sobbing, and not get over this for a long time, and maybe never be out of the shadow of the contrast between the drone's cool and her breakdown. Or... She took a deep breath, calmed herself. She walked up to the drone and said quietly,
"All right. This time, you get away with it. Enjoy it when you play it back."
She put one hand flat on the drone's side.
"Yeah, enjoy. But if you ever do anything like that again..."
She slapped its flank softly and whispered,
"You're awe, understand?"
"Absolutely," said the drone.
"Slag, components, mother junk."
"Ooh, please, no,"
Scaffin Amtiscor sighed.
"I'm serious. You use minimum force from now on. Understand? Agree?"
"Both."
She turned, picked up her bag, and headed for the door, glancing once into the adjoining room through the hole the first man had made. The woman in there had fled. The man's body was still crated into the wall, blood like rays of ejector. Smar looked back to the machine and spat on the floor.
"The xenophobe's heading this way,"
Scaffin Amtiscor said. Suddenly there in front of her, its body shining in the sunlight.
"Here."
It stretched a field out, offering her the little chain of bright flowers it had made. Smar bowed towards it. The machine slipped the chain over her head like a necklace. She stood up and they went back into the castle. The very top of the keep was out of bounds to the public. It bristled with aerials and masts and a couple of slowly revolving radar units. Two floors below, once the tour party had disappeared round the curve of the gallery, Smar and the machine stopped at a thick metal door. The drone used its electromagnetic effector to disable the door's alarm and open the electronic locks, then inserted a field into a mechanical lock, jiggled the tumblers, and swung the door wide. Smar slipped through, immediately followed by the machine, which relocked the door. They ascended to the broad, cluttered roof, beneath the vault of turquoise sky. A tiny scout missile the drone had sent ahead sidled up to the machine and was taken back inside.
"When's it get here?"
Smar said, listening to the warm wind hum through the jagged spaces of the aerials around her.
"It's over there,"
Scaffin Amtiscor said, jabbing forward. She looked in the direction it had indicated and could just make out the spare, curved outline of a four-person module sitting nearby. It was giving a very good impression of being transparent. Smar looked around the forest of masts and stays for a moment, the wind ruffling her hair, then shook her head. She walked to the module shape, momentarily dizzied by the sensation that there wasn't anything there, then that there was. A door swung up from the module side, revealing the interior as though opening a passageway into another world, which was, in a sense, she supposed, exactly what it was doing. She and the drone entered.
"Welcome aboard, Miss Smar," said the module.
"Hello." The door closed. The module tipped back on its rear end like a predator preparing to pounce. It waited a moment for a flock of birds to clear the airspace 100 meters above. Then it was gone, powering into the air. Watching from the ground, if they hadn't blinked at the wrong moment, a very keen-eyed observer might just have seen a column of trembling air flick skyward from the summit of the keep, but would have heard nothing. Even in high supersonic, the module could move more quietly than any bird, displacing tissue-thin layers of air immediately ahead of it, moving into the vacuum so created, and replacing the gases in the skin-thin space it had left behind. A falling feather produced more turbulence. Standing in the module, gazing at the main screen, Smar watched the view beneath the module shrink rapidly, as the concentric layers of the castle's defences came crashing in like time-reversed waves from the edges of the screen. The castle became a dot between the city and the straits, and then the city itself disappeared, and the view began to tip as the module angled out for its rendezvous with the very fast picket xenophobe. Smar sat down, still watching the screen, eyes searching in vain for the valley on the outskirts of the city where the dam and the old power station lay. The drone watched too, while it signalled to the waiting ship and received confirmation the vessel had displaced Smar's luggage out of the trunk of the car and into the woman's quarters on board. Scaffin Amtiscore studied Smar as she stared, a little glumly, it thought, at the hazing overview on the module screen, and wondered when the best time would be to give her the rest of the bad news. Because, despite all this wonderful technology, somehow, incredibly uniquely as far as the drone knew, how in the name of chaos did a lump of meat outwit and destroy a knife missile, the man called Sheradanin Zakalwe had shaken off the tail they'd put on him after he'd resigned the last time. So, before they did anything else, Smar and it had to find the damn human first, if they could. The figure slipped from behind a radar housing and crossed the keep's roof beneath the wind-moaning aerials. It went down the spiral of steps, checked all was clear beyond the thick metal door, then opened it. A minute later, something that looked exactly like Dizziat Smar joined the tour party, while the guide was explaining how developments in artillery, heavier than air flight and rocketry, had made the ancient fortress obsolete. Numeral 12. They shared their eyrie with the state coach of the Mythoclast, a cluttered army of statues, and a jumble of assorted chests, cases and cupboards, packed with treasure from a dozen great houses. Astil Tremurst Kyver selected a roquelaure from a tall chiffonier, closed the cabinet's door, and admired himself in the mirror. Yes, the cloak looked very fine on him, very fine indeed. He flourished it, pirouetting, drew his ceremonial rifle from its scabbard, and then made a circuit of the room around the grand state coach, making a kishaw, kishaw noise, and pointing the gun at each black-curtained window in turn as he swept by them, his shadow dancing gloriously across the walls and the cold grey outlines of the statues, before arriving back at the fireplace, sheathing the rifle and sitting suddenly and imperiously down on a highly wrought little chair of finest bloodwood. The chair collapsed. He thumped into the flagstones, and the holstered gun at the side fired, sending a round into the angle between the floor and the curve of wall behind him. "Shit, shit, shit!" he cried, inspecting his breeks and cloak, respectively grazed and holed. The door of the state coach burst open, and someone flew out, crashing into an escritoire and demolishing it. The man was still and steady in an instant, presenting, in that infuriatingly efficient martial way of his, the smallest possible target, and pointing the appallingly large and ugly plasma cannon straight at the face of the deputy vice-regent in waiting, Astil Tremurst Kyver VIII.
"Eek! Zakalwe!"
Kyver heard himself say, and threw the cloak over his head. Damn. When Kyver brought the cloak down again, with, he felt, all the not inconsiderable dignity he could muster, the mercenary was already rising from the debris of the little desk, taking a quick look round the room and switching off the plasma weapon. Kyver was, naturally, immediately aware of the hateful similarity of their positions, and so stood up quickly.
"Ah, Zakalwe, I beg your pardon, did I wake you?"
The man scowled, glanced down at the remains of the escritoire, slammed shut the door of the state coach and said, "No, just a bad dream."
"Ah, good."
Kyver fiddled with the ornamental pommel of his gun, wishing that Zakalwe didn't make him feel so unjustifiably, damn it, inferior. and crossed in front of the fireplace to sit, carefully this time, on a preposterous porcelain throne stationed to one side of the hearth. He watched the mercenary sit down on the hearthstone, leaving the plasma cannon on the floor in front of him and stretching.
Well, a half-watcher's sleep will have to suffice.
Kaiva
said, feeling awkward. He glanced at the ceremonial coach the other man had been sleeping in, and so recently vacated.
Ah!
Kaiva drew the rockalore about him and smiled.
I don't suppose you know the story behind that old carriage, do you?
The mercenary, the so-called war minister, shrugged.
Well, he said, the version I heard was that in the interregnum the archpresbyter told the mithoclast he could have the tribute, income and souls of all the monasteries he could raise his state coach above, using one horse. The mithoclast accepted, founded this castle and erected this tower with foreign loans, and using a highly efficient pulley system powered by his prized stallion, winched the coach up here during the 30 golden days to claim every monastery in the land. He won the bet and the resulting war, disestablished the final priesthood, paid off his debts, and only perished because the groom in charge of the prized stallion objected to the fact that the beast died of its exertions and strangled him with its blood and foam-flecked bridle, which, according to legend, is immured within the base of the porcelain throne you're sitting on. So we're told.
He looked at the other man and shrugged again. Kaiva was aware that his mouth was hanging open. He closed it.
Ah, you know the story.
No, just a wild guess.
Kaiva hesitated, then laughed loudly.
By hell, you're a rum chap, Sir Calloway.
The mercenary stirred the remains of the bloodwood chair with one heavily booted foot and said nothing. Kaiva was aware that he ought to do something, and so stood. He wandered to the nearest window, drew back the drape and unlocked the interior shutters, levered the external shutters aside and stood, arm against the stones, gazing out at the view beyond. The Winter Palace besieged. Outside on the snow-strewn plain, amongst the fires and trenches, there were huge wooden siege structures and missile launchers, heavy artillery and rock-throwing catapults, juried field projectors and gas-powered searchlights, a heinous collection of blatant anachronisms, developmental paradoxes and technological juxtapositions, and they called it progress.
I don't know,
Kaiva breathed.
Men fire guided missiles from their mount saddles. Jets are shot down by guided arrows, throw knives explode like artillery shells, or, like as not, get turned back by ancestral armour, backed by these damned field projectors. Where's it all to end, eh, Sir Calloway?
Here, in about 3 heartbeats, if you don't close those shutters or pull the blackout drapes behind you.
He stabbed at the logs in the grate with a poker.
Ha!
Kaiva withdrew rapidly from the window, half-ducking as he pulled the lever to close the external shutters.
Quite!
He hauled the drape across the window, dusting down his hands, watching the other man as he prodded at the logs in the fire.
Indeed!
He took his place on the porcelain throne again. Of course, Mr. So-called War Minister Sir Calloway liked to pretend he did have an idea where it was all going to end. He claimed to have some sort of explanation for it all, about outside forces, the balance of technology, and the erratic escalation of military wizardry. He always seemed to be hinting at greater themes and conflicts beyond the mere here and now, forever trying to establish some frankly laughable otherworldly superiority, as though that made any difference to the fact that he was nothing more than a mercenary. A very lucky mercenary, who'd happened to catch the ear of the sacred heirs and impress them with a mixture of absurdly risky exploits and cowardly plans, while the one he'd been paired with, him, Astil Tremurst Kaiva VIII, deputy regent-in-waiting, no less, had behind him 1,000 years of breeding, natural seniority and, indeed, for that was just the way things were, damn it, superiority. After all, what sort of war minister, even in these desperate days, was so incapable of delegating that he had to sit out a watch up here, waiting for an attack that would probably never come? Kaiva glanced at the other man, sitting staring into the flames, and wondered what he was thinking.
I blame Smar. She got me into this crock of shit.
He looked around the cluttered spaces of the room. What had he to do with idiots like Kaiva, with all this historical junk, with any of this? He didn't feel part of it, could not identify with it, and he did not entirely blame them for not listening to him. He supposed he did have the satisfaction of knowing that he had warned the fools,
but that was little enough to warm yourself with on a cold and closing night like this. He'd fought, put his life at risk for them, won a few desperate rearguard actions, and he'd tried to tell them what they ought to do. But they'd listened too late, and given him some limited power only after the war was already more or less lost. But that was just the way they were. They were the bosses, and if their whole way of life vanished, because it was a tenet of that way that people like them automatically knew how to make war better than even the most experienced commoners or outsiders, then that was not unjust. Everything came level in the end. And if it meant their deaths, let them all die. In the meantime, while supplies held out, what could be more pleasant? No more long cold marches, no boggy excuses for camps, no outside latrines, no scorched earth to try and scrape a meal from. Not much action, and maybe he would get itchy feet eventually, but that was more than compensated for by being able to satisfy the more highly placed itches of some of the noble ladies also trapped in the castle. Anyway, he knew in his heart that there was a relief in not being listened to sometimes. Power meant responsibility. Advice unacted upon almost always might have been right. And in the working out of whatever plan was followed, there was, anyway, always blood. Better it was on their hands. The good soldier did as he was told, and if he had any sense at all, volunteered for nothing, especially promotion.
"Ha!" Kyver said, rocking in the china chair. "We found more grass seed today."
"Oh, good."
"Indeed."
Most of the courtyards, gardens and patios were already given over to pasture. They'd torn the roofs off some of the less architecturally important halls and planted there as well. If they weren't blown to bits in the meantime, they might, in theory, feed a quarter of the castle's garrison indefinitely. Kyver shivered and wrapped the cloak more tightly about his legs.
"But this is a cold old place, Sir Calloway, isn't it?"
He was about to say something in reply when the door at the far end of the room opened a crack. He grabbed the plasma cannon.
Is everything all right?"
said a quiet female voice. He put the gun down, smiling at the small pale face peering from the doorway, long black hair following the line of the door's studded wood.
"Ah, Nainta!"
Kyver exclaimed, rising only to bow deeply to the young girl, princess indeed, who was, technically at least, not that that precluded other more productive, even lucrative relationships in the future, his ward. "Come on in," he heard the mercenary tell the girl.
"Damn him, always taking the initiative like that. Who did he think he was?"
The girl crept into the room, gathering her skirts in front of her.
"I thought I heard a shot."
The mercenary laughed. "That was a little time ago," he said, rising to show the girl to a seat near the fire.
"Well,"
she said,
"I had to dress."
The man laughed louder.
"My lady,"
Kyver said, rising slightly late and flourishing what would now, thanks to Sir Calloway, look like a rather awkward bow.
"For fend we should have disturbed your maidenly slumber."
Kyver heard the other man stifle a guffaw as he kicked a log further into the fire. The princess Nainta giggled. Kyver felt his face heat up and decided to laugh. Nainta, still very young, but already beautiful in a delicate, fragile way, wrapped her arms round her drawn-up legs and stared into the fire. He looked from her to Kyver in the silence that followed, except that the deputy vice-regent-in-waiting said,
"Yes, well,"
and thought, as the logs crackled and the scarlet flames danced, how like statues the two young people suddenly looked. "Just once," he thought, "I'd like to know whose side I'm really on in something like this. Here I am, in this absurd fortress packed with riches, crowned with concentrated nobility," such as it was, he thought, watching Kyver's vacant-looking eyes, facing out the hordes beyond, all claw and tackle, brute force and brute intelligence, trying to protect these delicate, simpering products of a millennia's privilege, and never knowing whether I'm doing the tactically or the strategically right thing. The mines did not assume such distinctions. To them, there was no cut-off between the two. Tactics cohered into strategy, strategy disintegrated into tactics in the sliding scale of their dialectical moral algebra. It was all more than they ever expected the mammal brain to cope with. He recalled what Smar had said to him long, long ago back in that new beginning,
itself the product of so much guilt and pain, that they dealt in the intrinsically untoward, where rules were forged as you went along and were never the same twice anyway, where, just by the nature of things, nothing could be known or predicted or even judged with any real certainty. It all sounded very sophisticated and abstract and challenging to work with, but in the end it came down to people and problems. This girl was what it came down to here, this time. Barely more than a child, and trapped in the great stone castle with the rest of the cream, or scum, depending on how you looked at it. To live or die, depending on how well I advise, and on how capable these clowns are of taking that advice. He looked at the girl's flame-lit face, and felt something more than distant desire, for she was attractive, or fatherly protectiveness, for she was so young, and he, despite his appearance, so old. Call it, he didn't know what. A realization, an awareness of the tragedy the whole episode represented, the breakup of the rule, the dissolution of power and privilege, and the whole elaborate, top-heavy system this child represented. The muck and dirt, the king with fleas. For theft, mutilation. For the wrong thoughts, death. An infant mortality rate as astronomical as the life expectancy was minute. And the whole grisly working package wrapped in a skein of wealth and advantage designed to maintain the dark dominion of the knowing over the ignorant. And the worst of it was the pattern, the repetition, the twisted variations of the same depraved theme in so many different places. So this girl, called a princess, would she die? The war was going against them, he knew. And the same symbolic grammar that presented her with the prospect of power if things went well also dictated her use, her expendability, if all failed about them. Rank demanded its tribute, the obsequious bow or the mean stab, according to the outcome of this struggle. He saw her suddenly old in the flickering firelight. He saw her shut in some slimed dungeon, waiting, hoping, scabbed with lice and ragged in sackcloth, head-shaved, eyes dark and hollow in the raw skin, and finally marched out one snow-filled day to be nailed to a wall with arrows or bullets, or face the cold axe blade. Or maybe that too was too romantic. Maybe there would be some desperate flight to asylum, a lonely and bitter exile spent growing old and worn, barren and senile, forever remembering the evermore golden old times, composing futile petitions, hoping for a return, but growing, slowly, inevitably, into something like the pampered uselessness her upbringing had always conditioned her for, but without any of the compensations she'd been bred to expect from her station. With a feeling of sickness, he saw that she meant nothing. She was just another irrelevant part of another history, heading, with or without the culture's carefully evaluated nudges in what they saw as the right direction, for what would probably be better times and an easier life for most. But not her, he suspected. Not right at this moment. Born 20 years earlier, she might have expected a good marriage, a productive estate, access to the court and lusty sons, talent and daughters. 20 years from now, perhaps an astutely mercantile husband, or even, in the unlikely event this particular genderist society was heading that way so soon, a life of her own. Academic, in business, doing good works, whatever. But probably death. High in a turret of a great castle, rising on a black crag above snowy plains, besieged and grand, crammed full of an empire's treasure, and he, sitting by a log fire, was a sad and lovely princess. I used to dream about such things, he thought. I used to long for them, ache for them. They seemed the very stuff of life. Its essence. So why does all this taste of ashes? I should have stayed on that beach, Smar. Perhaps, after all, I am getting too old for this. He made himself look away from the girl. Smar said he tended to get too involved, and she was not totally wrong. He'd done what they'd asked. He'd be paid, and at the end of all this, after all, there was his own attempt to claim absolution for a past crime. Livueta, say you will forgive me. Oh, the Princess Ninta had just noticed the wreckage of the Bloodwood chair. Yes. Kaiva stirred uncomfortably. That was
me, I'm afraid. Was it yours? Your family's?
Oh, no. But I knew it. It belonged to my uncle, the Archduke. It used to be in his hunting lodge. It had a great big animal's head above it. I was always frightened to sit in it, because I dreamt the head would fall from the wall and one of the tusks would stick right into my head and I'd die.
She looked at both men in turn and giggled nervously.
Wasn't I silly?
Ha! Said Kaiva,
while he watched them both and shivered and tried to smile.
Well, Kaiva laughed, you must promise not to tell your uncle that I broke his little seat, or I shall never be invited to one of his hunts again.
Kaiva laughed louder.
Why? I might even end up with my head fixed on one of his walls.
The girl squealed and put a hand to her mouth. He looked away, shivering again, then threw a piece of wood onto the fire, and did not notice then or afterwards that it was a piece of the bloodwood chair he had added to the flames, and not a log at all. Chapter 3 Smar suspected a lot of ship crews were crazy. For that matter, she suspected a fair few of the ships themselves weren't totally together in the sanity department either. There were only 20 people on the very fast picket Xenophobe, and Smar had noticed that, as a general rule, the smaller the crew, the weirder the behaviour. So she was already prepared for the ship's staff being pretty off the wall, even before the module entered the ship's hangar. The young crewman sneezed, covering his nose with one hand while extending the other to Smar as she stepped from the module. Smar jerked her hand back, looking at the young man's red nose and streaming eyes.
Estiskov, Miss Smar,
the fellow said, blinking and sniffing and looking hurt.
Back up, boys.
Smar put her hand out again cautiously. The crewman's hand was extremely hot.
Thank you, Smar said.
Scathin Amtiskor, the drone said from behind her.
Hello.
The young man waved at the drone. He took a small piece of cloth from one sleeve and dabbed at his leaky eyes and nose.
Are you entirely all right? Smar said.
Don't really, he said. Got a cold. Please.
He indicated to one side.
Come with me.
A cold?
Smar nodded, falling into step alongside the fellow. He was dressed in a jalaba, as though he'd just got out of bed.
Yes,
the young man said, leading the way through the Xenophobe's collection of small craft, satellites and assorted paraphernalia towards the rear of the hangar. He sneezed again, sniffed.
Something of a fad on the ship at the moment.
Here, Smar, immediately behind the man as they walked between two closely parked modules, turned quickly back to look at Scaffin Amtiskor and mouthed the word, What? At it. But the machine wobbled, shrugging. Me neither, it printed on its aura field, in letters of grey on a rosy background.
They all thought it'd be amusing to relax our immune systems and catch colds,
the young crewman explained, showing her and the drone into an elevator at one end of the hangar.
All of you?
Smar said, as the door closed and the elevator rolled and rose.
The whole crew?
Yes. They're not all at the same time. The people who recovered said it's very pleasant and it's over.
Yes,
Smar said, glancing at the drone, which was keeping a standard pattern of formal blue on its aura field, apart from one large red dot on its side that probably only she could see. It was pulsing rapidly. When she noticed it, she almost started laughing herself. She cleared her throat.
Yes, I suppose it would be.
The young man sneezed mightily.
Due for a spot of R&R soon, are we?
Scaffin Amtiskor asked him. Smar nudged the machine with her elbow. The young crewman looked puzzledly at the machine.
Just finished some, actually.
He glanced away to the elevator door as it started to open. Scaffin Amtiskor and Smar exchanged looks. Smar crossed her eyes. They stepped into a wide social area, floored and walled with some dark red wood, polished to the point of gleaming. It supported a variety of richly upholstered couches and chairs, and a few low tables. The ceiling wasn't particularly high, but very attractive, composed of great flutes of gathered-up material rippling in from the walls and hung with many little lanterns. From the light level, it looked to be early morning ship time. A group of people round one of the tables broke up and came towards her.
Miss Smar,
the young crewman said, indicating Smar, his voice seeming to get thicker all the time. The other people, about 50-50 men and women, smiled, introduced themselves. She nodded, exchanged a few words. The drone said hello. One of the people in the group held a little bundle of brown and yellow fur, cradled against one shoulder, rather as one might hold a baby. "Here," the man said, presenting the tiny furry creature to Sma. She took it reluctantly. It was warm, had four limbs arranged conventionally, smelled attractive, and wasn't any sort of animal she'd ever seen before. It had large ears on a large head, and as she held it, it opened its huge eyes and looked at her. "That's the ship," the man who handed her the animal said.
"Hello,"
the tiny being squeaked. Sma looked it up and down.
"You're the xenophobe?"
"It's representative. The bit you can talk to. You can call me Zenny."
It smiled. It had little round teeth.
"I know most ships just use a drone, but..."
It glanced at Scaven Amtiscor.
"They can be a bit boring, don't you think?"
Sma smiled and sensed Scaven Amtiscor's aura flicker out of the corner of her eye.
"Well, sometimes," she agreed.
"Oh, yes,"
the little creature said, nodding.
"I'm much cuter."
It wriggled in her hands, looking happy.
"If you like,"
it giggled,
"I'll show you to your cabin, yes?"
"Yes, good idea," nodded Sma, and put the thing over her shoulder.
The crew people called out to say they'd see her later, as she, the ship's bizarre remote drone, and Scaven Amtiscor headed for the accommodation section.
"Oh, you're nice and warm,"
the little brown and yellow creature mumbled sleepily, snuggling into Sma's neck as they headed down a deeply carpeted corridor for Sma's quarters. It stirred, and she found herself patting its back.
"Left here,"
it said at a junction. Then,
"That's us just breaking orbit now, by the way."
"Good," Sma said.
"Can I cuddle up with you when you sleep?"
Sma stopped, detached the creature from her shoulder with one hand, and stared it in the face.
"What?"
"Just for chumminess' sake,"
the little thing said, yawning wide and blinking.
"I'm not being rude. It's a good bonding procedure."
Sma was aware of Scaven Amtiscor glowing red just behind her. She brought the yellow and brown device closer to her face.
"Listen, xenophobe."
"Zenny."
"Zenny, you are a million-ton starship. A torturer-class rapid offensive unit, even..."
"But I'm demilitarized."
"Even without your principal armament, I bet you could waste planets if you wanted to."
"Oh, come on! Any silly GCU can do that!"
"So what is all this shit for?"
She shook the furry little remote drone quite hard. Its teeth chattered.
"It's for a laugh!"
it cried.
"Sma, don't you appreciate a joke?"
"I don't know. Do you appreciate being drop-kicked back to the accommodation area?"
"Oh, what's your problem, lady? Have you got something against small furry animals or what? Look, Miss Sma, I know very well I'm a ship, and I do everything I'm asked to do, including taking you to this frankly rather fuzzily specified destination, and do it very efficiently, too. If there was the slightest sniff of any real action and I had to start acting like a warship, this construct in your hands would go lifeless and limp immediately, and I'd battle as ferociously and decisively as I've been trained to. Meanwhile, like my human colleagues, I amuse myself harmlessly. If you really hate my current appearance, all right, I'll change it. I'll be an ordinary drone, or just a disembodied voice, or talk to you through Scaven Amtiscor here, or through your personal terminal. The last thing I want to do is offend a guest."
Sma pursed her lips. She patted the thing on its head and sighed.
"Fair enough."
"I can keep this shape?"
"By all means."
"Oh, goody!"
It squirmed with pleasure, then opened its big eyes wide and looked hopefully at her.
"Cuddle?"
"Cuddle."
Sma cuddled it, patted its back. She turned to see Scaven Amtiscor lying dramatically on its back in midair, its aura field flashing the lurid orange that was used to signal sick drone in extreme distress. Sma nodded goodbye to the little brown and yellow animal as it waddled away down the corridor which led back to the social area. It waved back with one chubby little paw, then closed the cabin door and made sure the room's internal monitoring was off. She turned to Scafinantiskor.
How long are we on this ship for?
30 days,
Scafinantiskor suggested. Smar gritted her teeth and looked round the fairly cosy-looking but, compared to the echoing spaces of the old power station mansion, rather small cabin.
30 days with a crew of viral masochists and a ship that thinks it's a cuddly toy.
She shook her head, sat into the bedfield.
Subjectively, Drone, this could be a long trip.
She collapsed back into the bed, muttering. Scafinantiskor decided right now would probably still not be the best time to tell the woman about Zakalwe being missing.
I'll just go and take a look around, if you don't mind, it said,
drifting towards the door over the neat line of bags that was Smar's luggage.
Yeah, on you go.
Smar waved one arm lazily, then shucked off the jacket and let it fall to the deck. The drone had almost made it to the door when Smar sat bolt upright, a frown on her face, and said,
Wait a minute. What did the ship mean about rather fuzzily specified destination? Doesn't it know where the hell we're going?
Uh-oh, thought the drone.
It spun in the air.
Ah,
it said. Smar's eyes narrowed.
We are just going to get Zakalwe, aren't we?
Yes, of course.
We're not doing anything else?
Absolutely not. We find Zakalwe, we brief him, we take him to Verenhut's. Simple as that. We might be asked to hang around for a bit, overseeing, but that isn't definite yet.
Yes, yes, I expected that, but... Where exactly is Zakalwe?
Where exactly? The drone said. Well, I mean, you know, that's all right,
Smar said, exasperated. Approximately, then.
No problem,
Scafinantiskor said, backing off towards the door.
No problem? Smar said, puzzled.
Yes, no problem. We know that, where he is.
Good.
Smar nodded.
Well?
Well what?
Well, Smar said loudly, where is he?
Crastalia.
Crastalia.
That's where we're heading.
Smar shook her head, yawned.
Never heard of it.
She flopped back in the bedfield, stretching.
Crastalia.
Her yawn deepened. She put a hand to her mouth.
You only had to say that the first time, goddammit.
Sorry,
the drone said.
Never mind.
Smar put out one hand, waved it through the bedside beam that controlled the cabin lights so that they dimmed. She yawned again.
Think I'll catch some sleep. Take my boots off, will you?
Gently, but quickly, the drone slipped Smar's boots off, gathered her jacket, and hung it in a walk-in cupboard. Swept the bags in there, too. Then, as Smar turned over in the bedfield, eyes fluttering closed, the drone slipped out of the room. It hovered in the air outside, looking at its reflection in the polished wood on the far side of the corridor.
That, it said to itself, was close.
Then it went for a wander. Smar had arrived on the Xenophobe just after breakfast by ship time. When she awoke, it was early afternoon. She was completing her toilet while the drone sorted her clothes into type and colour order and hung or folded them in the cupboard when the door chimed. Smar wandered out of the little bathroom area, wearing a pair of shorts, her mouth full of toothpaste. She tried saying, "Open," but the toothpaste apparently stopped the room monitor from recognising the word. She walked over and pressed the "door open" instead. Smar's eyes flicked wide. She yelped, spluttered, jumped back from the door, a scream gathering in her throat. The instant after her eyes had widened, before the signal to jump back from the door had travelled all the way to her leg muscles, there was an impression of almost invisibly sudden movement in the cabin, belatedly followed by a bang and a sizzling sound. There, stationed between her and the door, were all three of the drone's knife missiles, hovering roughly level with her eyes, sternum and groin. She was looking at them through a haze field the machine had also thrown in front of her. Then it clicked off. The knife missiles swung lazily away through the air and clicked back into Scafinantiskor's casing.
Don't do that to me,
the machine muttered, returning to sorting out Smar's socks. Smar wiped her mouth and stared at the 3-metre-tall, brown and yellow-coloured furry monster cowering in the corridor outside the door.
Ship! Zenny, what the hell are you doing?
I'm sorry, the huge creature said, its voice only a little deeper than when it had been baby-sized. I thought if you didn't relate to a small furry animal, perhaps a bigger version.
Shit, Smar said, shaking her head. Come in, she called, heading back for the bathroom area. Or did you just want to show me how much you've grown?
She rinsed out the paste and spat. Zenny squeezed through the door, stooped and sidled into a corner.
Sorry about that, Scaffanamptiscore.
No problem, the other machine replied.
No, Miss Smar, Zenny called. I actually wanted to talk to you about...
Scaffanamptiscore went still, just for a second. There was, in fact, a fairly lengthy, detailed and slightly heated exchange between the drone and the ship's mind during that time. But Smar was only aware of Zenny pausing as it spoke.
About having a fancy dress party this evening, in your honour, the ship improvised.
Smar smiled from the bathroom area.
That's a lovely idea, ship. Thank you, Zenny.
Yes, why not?
Good. I just thought I'd check with you first. Any ideas about costumes?
Smar laughed.
Yeah, I'll go as you. Make me one of those suits you're wearing.
Ha, yes. Good idea. Actually, that might be a rather common choice, but we'll make it two people can't go as the same thing. Right, I'll talk to you later.
Zenny lumbered from the room, and the door slid shut. Smar appeared out from the bathroom area, slightly surprised at this sudden departure, but just shrugged.
Short but eventful visit, she observed,
rummaging through the socks Scaffanamptiscore had just carefully arranged in chromatic order.
That machine's weird.
What do you expect? Scaffanamptiscore said. It's a starship.
You might, the ship mind communicated to Scaffanamptiscore, have told me you were keeping the size of our target destination from her.
I am hoping, the drone replied, that our people already out there will find the guy we're looking for and give us an exact position, in which case Smar will never need to know there was ever any problem.
Indeed, but why not just be honest with her in the first place?
Ha, you don't know Smar.
Oh, do I take it she's temperamental?
What do you expect? She's a human.
The ship prepared a feast and put as many human brain chemistry-altering chemicals into the various dishes and drinks as was normally regarded proper, without attaching a specific sanity warning to each bowl, plate, jug or glass. It told the crew about the party and rearranged the social area, setting up a variety of mirrors and reverser fields, with a total guest list of only 22, not including itself. Making the place look suitably crowded was one of the major obstacles it faced in trying to encourage the feel of a serious, thoroughgoing whoopee. Smar breakfasted, was shown round the ship, though there was little to see, the ship was almost all engine, and spent most of the rest of the day reviewing her knowledge of the Verdenherz cluster's history and politics. The ship sent formal invitations to each of the crew and specified a strict rule of no shop talk. It hoped that this, plus the narcotic wealth of the consumables, would keep everybody off the subject of where exactly they were heading for. It had toyed with the idea of just telling people there was a problem here and asking them not to talk about it, but suspected there were at least two of the crew who would take such a prescription as a challenge to their integrity, requiring them to raise the issue at the first possible opportunity. It was on occasions like this that the xenophobe tended to consider changing its status to that of an unstaffed ship, but it knew it would miss the humans if it did decide to ask them to leave. They were fun to have around, usually. The ship played loud music, showed exciting screen hollows, and set up a fabulous surrounding hollow landscape of lush green and blue, filled with floating bushes and hovering trees, where strange eight-winged birds capered, and beyond which a glowing white layer of mist, plied by tall, feathery cloud ships, extended to neck-stretchingly tall cliffs of pastel-shaded rock, set about with further small clouds, draped with blue and sparkling gold waterfalls, and topped by fabulous cities of spires and slender bridges. Ship-slaved soligrams of famous historical figures wandered about the party, adding to the illusion of numbers, and were only too happy to engage the disguised revellers in conversation. More treats and surprises were promised for later. Smar went as Zenny, Scaffanamptiscore as a model of the xenophobe, and the ship itself produced yet another remote drone, an aquatic one, still brown and yellow, but looking like a rather fat and large-eyed fish, and floating in a field-held metre-diameter sphere of water,
which drifted through the party space like some odd balloon.
Hi, Streskov. Who you've met before,
the ship drone said, voice sounding rather bubbly as it introduced Smart to the young man who'd greeted her in the hangar the day before.
And Jitart Hein.
Smart smiled, nodded at Disgarv, making a mental note to stop thinking of him as Disgarb, and the young woman at his side.
Hello again. How do you do?
Hello,
said Disgarv, dressed as some sort of ancient cold climate explorer, all swathed in furs.
Hi, Jitart Hein said. She was quite short and round, very young-looking, and her skin was so black it was almost blue. She wore some ancient and surprisingly brightly coloured military uniform and sported a smoothbore projectile rifle slung over one shoulder. She sipped from a glass and said,
I know there's no shop talk, Miss Ma, but frankly, Ais and I have been wondering why our des...
Ah!
The ship drone said, its water sphere suddenly collapsing. Water crashed all around the feet of Smar, Hrein and Disgarv, all of whom jumped back a little. The fish drone fell to the redwood deck and flapped around.
Water!
It croaked. Smar picked it up by the tail.
What happened? She asked it.
Failed malfunction. Oh, water, quickly!
Smar looked at Disgarv and Hrein, both of whom seemed rather bemused. Scaffin Amtiskor, in its starship disguise, wound quickly through the partygoers towards them.
Water!
The ship drone repeated, wriggling. A frown gathered on Smar's brow, inside the brown and yellow suit. She looked at the woman dressed as a soldier.
What were you about to say, Miss Hrein?
I was... Oof!
A 1 in 512 scale model of the very fast picket xenophobe thumped into the woman, making her stagger backwards, dropping her glass.
Hey!
Disgarv said, pushing the offending Scaffin Amtiskor away. Hrein looked annoyed and rubbed her shoulder.
Sorry, clumsy me,
Scaffin Amtiskor said loudly.
Whata! Whata!
Yelped the ship drone, struggling in Smar's furry paw.
Shut up,
Smar told it. She went close to Jitart Hein, putting her own body between the woman and Scaffin Amtiskor.
Miss Hein, complete your question, would you?
I just wanted to know why...
The floor shook. The entire landscape around them trembled. Light flashed from high above, and as they looked up, they saw the fabulous gleaming cities of the clifftops far above disappear in vast blooms of light, which slowly faded, leaving falling...